Hello, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's Today's Topics in Health Disparities. I'm Kara James, the Foundation's Senior Policy Analyst on Race, Ethnicity, and Healthcare. Today's Topics is a series of conversations that address issues relating to health and healthcare disparities in the U.S. Today's topic, the effect of the economic downturn on the health of communities of color, comes in the midst of a serious economic crisis. Last month alone, more than 650,000 jobs were lost, and the national unemployment rate rose by 0.5% to just over 8%. Our conversation today will focus on how the recession is affecting communities of color with respect to housing and employment, as well as its impact on health coverage, access to care, and health outcomes. We will also discuss how states are adjusting to the rising demand for public programs such as Medicaid, and potential strategies for improving the situation. We welcome your questions, so feel free to email us. The address is ask@kff.org. Our panel today includes three distinguished guests whose bios are available on our website. In our studio, we have Dr. William Spriggs, professor and chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. Next to him is Adrian Hahn, senior attorney and program manager at Consumers Union. And joining us by telephone is Dr. Lauren Smith, medical director for the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. I want to thank you all for joining us. So, Dr. Spriggs, I'd like to start with you. If you could just give us a lay of the land of what is going on with the economic crisis for the entire country.
Well, we have several crises going on at the same time. Mm-hmm. Over the 8 years that we called a recovery, 2000 to 2008, incomes remained flat. So we actually saw no gains for the first time since we started keeping these records mm-hmm. in income over an eight-year period. In consequence, people borrowed money in order to maintain their lifestyles. We told them the economy was turning around, and they thought it would. Mm-hmm. And their home values went up, so they were also told, you're wealthier, so it's okay to borrow against that. So the one thing that happened is we got more and more in debt on the household sector side. The federal government was also running debts. And if you keep circulating debt, that means that you're going to clog the arteries of the financial system, which we did. So one problem is this financial crisis of all this debt, which, as it turns out, was being backed by home values, which we now know weren't sustainable. Then we have this other problem, which is when all of that borrowing stopped, consumption stopped, that meant that you don't need to hire anyone because no one's buying anything. And now we have another problem, which is in the real economy, that is where we actually produce, sell, buy things. And so we've seen unemployment increase at an unbelievable rate, historic rates. In the last couple of months, we've lost close to 2 million jobs, a rate that's really scary. So we have the financial crisis. We have the crisis of the household sector being in debt to the level that it is. And then we have this real economy problem because we don't have consumption driving hiring. So we've had layoffs at a very rapid rate. And this has been across the board. It has affected every industry except healthcare and the public sector so far. And it has affected all education levels. Those who are college educated have seen their unemployment rates go up, as is true for everyone down to high school dropouts. And it's been in almost every state. So it's not as if there's some states that have been more heavily impacted, as was the case in the recession we had in the 1990s. So it's a deep and wide recession. It's global. People in the United States think we have it bad, but actually our recession is not as bad as most other countries. So there are a lot of things going wrong at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So let's bring it down to sort of the focus of our conversation today, communities of color. And Ms. Hahn, what is happening in communities of color at this moment with regards to the economic downturn?
Well, we know that minorities have higher rates of being uninsured. African-American, Latinos, and Asians have a higher propensity of being uninsured compared to whites. And We know that folks that are uninsured don't receive the same level of care as those that are insured. So we're seeing them cutting back on care, reducing their medications, not visiting their providers more frequently, even for those folks who have chronic conditions. So that doesn't even, so that's just like the most immediate and obvious. But that does not even speak to the issue of the stress that is occurring. As you were just talking about how the economy is failing, so many Americans, even if you do have a job, are feeling the stress of the situation, which can also, as we know, exasperate person's health. So it's a really problematic issue in the minority community, and particularly because of the fact that we know minorities have a propensity for having a higher disease rates in relation to heart, relation to diabetes, and in relation to cancer. And two-thirds of healthcare costs in this country are attributable to those three diseases. So, you know, it's difficult to say what it will be in the long term, but certainly we know that many of these conditions must be worsening as a result of the fact that they're not receiving the appropriate level of care.
Okay. So we sort of introduced the health topic a little before we sort of said, well, you know, what's happening just in terms of the economy, job loss, and housing for our communities of color? What do we see going on there?
Well, the initial impact in the housing sector happened in the African American and Latino neighborhoods because they had always been excluded from the conventional loan system, the standard loan, the one that everybody would like to have. If you don't get that, then you're not getting the prime type of loan, so you're getting a subprime loan. Well, the rejection rate for African Americans who have high income, those with incomes above $160,000, looks like the rejection rate for whites with low income, those with income below $40,000. So, of course, there are a lot of people who looked at that and said, wow, there's a market there, and they seized upon it. Unfortunately, they were the wrong characters to seize upon it. And they gave defective mortgage instruments. These are instruments which make money for the seller, but are bad for the borrower. And they were predicated upon the housing values continuing to increase. The moment housing values didn't continue to increase, then the whole instrument becomes a bad instrument. And we saw mortgage foreclosure rates rise rapidly in the African American and Latino neighborhoods where these instruments were targeted as early as 2005 and 2006. These were at record levels. No one wanted to pay attention. They didn't want to hear the warning signs about correcting these instruments and getting people into proper loans. And unfortunately, because this was the unregulated portion of the mortgage sector, one portion is regulated by the Federal Reserve and by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and by the Comptroller of the Currency. There's a Community Reinvestment Act. There are all sorts of watchdogs in the conventional loan market. There were no watchdogs in this other market. This was done totally outside of bounds. They invented their own insurance, and so today we were bailing out all of these banks that bought that paper, and we're bailing out AIG, which was the insurance company that came up with these ingenious ways of giving people the sense that they could sell these loans in this unconventional market. So the rest of us are now paying for that level of discrimination. If those high-income African-American households had been put into conventional loans as they should have, the market for these other folks who got the loans would have been too tiny and no one would have gone after them anyway and would have ignored them. But the foreclosure rates that we're hearing initially hit the Black and Latino market. They were very severe. We're continuing to go through that problem. This is the biggest drop in wealth in the African American community since the fall of agricultural prices in World War I. Mm-hmm. Unemployment has gone up. It's now close to 14% for those in the African-American community. It has been at double digits for a year. The Hispanic community has an unemployment rate between the 8% and the 14%. It's continuing to go up for them as well. Hispanics relied very heavily on the construction industry, which has totally collapsed. So in terms of job prospects, this has been a very bad market for African-Americans. And again, across the board at all education levels, the unemployment rate for those with college degrees has gone up dramatically. Those who have associate degrees has almost seen their unemployment rate double. So this is a very severe downturn affecting the broad area of African Americans. And the foreclosures aren't low income. Those foreclosure rates are among high income African Americans. This is why we're seeing the dramatic drop in wealth in the community.
And that's a good question. You mentioned wealth. And what are some of the wealth differences that we see between African Americans and Latinos and their white counterparts?
Well, we know, just looking at the last time that we had a recession, between 1999 and 2002, that by 2002, the economic gap or divide between whites was 11 times greater for Latinos and 14 times greater for African Americans. And as you were just talking about the foreclosures, credit card debt, all of these issues combined make it very difficult for those folks who are even insured, have access to the wealth to pay for their medications, to see a dietitian so that they can get their dietary issues addressed appropriately, to address fitness issues and things so that we can work on prevention. So as long as people don't have that cushion in terms of additional cash and resources, it makes it even more difficult for those who have insurance to act appropriately and engage in the preventions that we all know will help save money in the long term. But for those who are uninsured, we know that the hurdles that they face in terms of being able to access appropriate care are enormous.
So, Dr. Smith, I'd like to ask you, you know, you're at the state level and kind of we've talked about these numbers nationally, but what do you see happening in Massachusetts?
Well, I think you all have raised some very interesting points. I think what I would like to point out is that while health coverage, health insurance is a critical part of maintaining health, it is not the only part or perhaps sometimes even the most important part. The impact of social factors on the development of illness and the patterns of illness really is one that we are very aware of in the Department of Public Health, and it has well established in the literature in the terms of exposures to substandard housing, to differential rates of environmental air pollution and other kinds of exposures, the kinds of burdens of disease that low-income and minority folks carry with them before they even enter the healthcare system, even when they are insured. Those things speak to the issues that the other panelists have raised in terms of what kind of neighborhood can you afford to be in, what kind of access to things that promote health, like physical activity in a safe environment, access to grocery stores, what's the proportion of liquor stores and fast food restaurants in your neighborhood, advertisements for smoking and alcohol. Those things are all what we would call these social factors that have a direct relationship both to the complex interplay of race and income in our communities. So I would say that anything that has an adverse impact on the overall sort of social environment we know is going to ultimately have an impact on health, because those social factors are such important drivers of health and well-being.
Okay. So one of the things that I kind of want to make the point and just drive it home for a second is this link between employment and health. And, I mean, from a very basic standpoint, it's the link between health coverage and, you know, your employment, since most Americans do receive their coverage through an employer. So just broadly speaking, what do we see or can we expect to happen as the unemployment rate rises and the coverage access, and then we move into talking about the coverage and what it means for health care, but also the other social determinants that Dr. Smith was just mentioning?
Well, the Economic Recovery Act that was passed and that the president put through very quickly provided help for workers in making their payments to continue their health insurance. The problem is that only a third or about a third of workers who are unemployed actually draw unemployment insurance. So this assistance isn't, unfortunately, this assistance is not going to go out to many workers who are losing their jobs. The Act also attempted to encourage states to expand coverage of unemployment insurance, but we saw in the response that Governor Jindal of Louisiana gave that there are many governors who are balking at getting unemployment insurance coverage to their citizens. So a state like Louisiana, which is well below the national average in terms of the share of unemployed workers who get unemployment insurance, are not going to get unemployment insurance and therefore won't get this continued coverage. African Americans are more likely than whites to be members of labor unions and therefore are slightly more likely to have access to employer-based health insurance and are slightly more likely to have access to pension funds because of their unionization rate. But they also tend to be lower paid, and so while the workers may have access themselves to health insurance, they often don't have the money to cover their children. So the big gap tends to be not just the workers, but in coverage for children. So in this pressure-filled environment where a lot of companies are trying to cut corners, we're going to continue to see pressure for companies to not offer to pay for family coverage or to increase the out-of-pocket expense that workers will have to pay to continue their coverage. And that's going to put additional strain on black families who keep their job to keep their health insurance, at least for their family members, in addition to which, we have folks who are losing jobs. So there's going to be a lot of difficulty in accessing health insurance coverage.
Mm-hmm. And we already know that those folks that are uninsured are twice as likely to have difficulty paying for housing and paying for food. So, I mean, that's just a basic bottom line. And we also know that healthcare expenses are the leading reason that folks are declaring bankruptcy. And two-thirds of those folks actually had insurance coverage. So it's not as the other speaker said, it's not the end-all, be-all to have health insurance coverage, but certainly can make your life a lot more easier. And if you're suffering from some type of chronic condition, it can help to ensure that you receive the appropriate care that you need so you don't compound that condition. But as long as we continue to see these unemployment rates at the existing levels that we're at, we're certainly going to see this correlation between more and more folks pulling down and declaring bankruptcy and what that will have on the economy in terms of ability to ensure that we have the consumer demand to be able to pull ourselves out of this.
Mm-hmm. One thing I would sort of add to this discussion is that we know that when folks look at their disposable income and their family budget, that the first things that people try to pay for are the bigger ticket items like their rent or their housing costs. Mm-hmm. And any time that exceeds more than 40 to 50% of their income, we know that there are going to be other things that we still would consider necessities that are going to be put off. And for many folks, that ends up leading to food instability because they reduce their expenditures on food, and they also reduce their expenditures on out-of-pocket health care costs. So that might have an impact on whether or not people can fill their prescriptions, even if they have a $10 copay. If you, are really strapped, that $10, needs to be put to some other use, even though you do have insurance. And mm-hmm. what we need to, I think, in the health care and the public health setting be prepared for is to look for changes in patterns of care seeking, that is, how people are using the healthcare system and what any shifts from primary care to emergency kind of services on the one hand, and also be prepared to think about what would be considered sentinel conditions, the kind of conditions that give us, that we would expect to increase in times of great sort of economic or fiscal upheaval.
That's a very good point, Dr. Smith. And in terms of our ability to monitor what's happening, we have the Bureau of Labor Statistics produces monthly economic numbers that tell us what's happening on the employment side. Do we have that same ability in the healthcare system?
Well, within our state, we are looking at such issues as emergency department visits. We're looking at what's called sort of preventable emergency department visits. That is, if you had had access to primary care, would this visit have been necessary?
Mm-hmm.
We're also thinking about, so that's a utilization kind of way of keeping track of things,
mm-hmm.
but we also have mechanisms for keeping track of specific conditions or diagnoses that one could imagine would be these sentinel conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So in times of difficult economic times, one might expect that substance abuse might increase as people are struggling with the kinds of stresses that Ms. Hahn and Dr. Spriggs talked about in terms of those family economic stresses. We might look at whether or not there are increases in cases of domestic violence or child neglect referrals to our social service system. So there's a host of things that if one thinks about what happens to families as their economic situation disintegrates and deteriorates, you know, we can look in the direction that we might be able to see those things so that we can be prepared and be able to respond.
Okay. So have you seen any changes in those numbers, or is that something that's ongoing at this moment?
Well, it's ongoing because, as you recall, I mean, this really, for collecting data on the state level, if we think about these things, the process of unraveling, if you will, at the national level happening in the late fall, it's going to take a little bit of time to be able to see the impact of that on data at a state level. I can say that, you know, we have in 2008 seen an increase in both the rates of unemployment, which you were talking about, for our Black and Hispanic residents. So we know we've seen that, and we're likely to then be able to see what the impacts of that are sort of after that. And there are substantial differences as we look at non-emergency room use, for example, where our Latino residents are more than twice as likely to have had to go to the emergency room for a non-emergency reason.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are the kinds of things that we are going to keep track of.
Okay. And so before we sort of move a little bit more into how the health system is dealing with this, Dr. Smith, I wanted to ask you, I know you are a pediatrician by training, and how do we expect that the economic downturn might appear differently in children, or do we think that the manifest of the family will wear differently on children than it does the parents?
Well, actually, that's an excellent question. I think that you could think about it in several different ways. The first is, you know, children by definition are affected by anything that happens in their family context. So they're not immune to the kinds of psychological stressors that the parents are experiencing. So in terms of a developmental or behavioral approach, we might expect a change in kids' behaviors at school, maybe difficulty sleeping or other sorts of behaviors that indicate anxiety or stress as children reflect the anxiety and perhaps depression or other kinds of disorders that their parents have. So I think we could certainly expect to see that. In terms of more health or material ways, we have in Massachusetts already noted an increase in subsidized school lunches, for example. You know, there are 13,000 more kids on who receive federally subsidized reduced or free lunches than we had last year. So that tells us that families are really stretched and that they're having to change what have been their usual patterns. And so for some kids, that's going to require real adjustments to what kind of lifestyle they had, and that will undoubtedly have some emotional effects. The other piece that Dr. Spriggs mentioned about health insurance for children, luckily in Massachusetts we have pretty low rates of uninsurance for children, but there's still the issue of underinsurance and whether or not families will be able to afford the co-pays. And a particular vulnerable group would be kids who have chronic illness who families need to take for regular appointments, you know, to maintain their illness if for some reason they're not able to pay the co-pays if they are insured, or if they become uninsured due to a loss of a job, one could expect that they would rely instead on urgent care visits instead of the preventative maintenance visits, say for a child with asthma or a child with seizure disorder. So the same patterns of changing how people seek and obtain care that you see in the adult world, you would in fact expect to see in for children as well.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about how the health system is kind of weathering all of these changes and the increased use. And in particular, obviously, you know, Medicaid is the program that we see as helping people who are low income, and as Dr. Smith just mentioned, with the Mass CHIP program for the children. And so what would we expect to see happen for Medicaid at this point as the unemployment rate is continuing to rise?
Well, we know that Medicaid numbers are increasing, and that's why, as a part of the Economic Recovery Act that was passed, there was an increase in the FMAP formula so that states would have the ability to draw down on more federal dollars to assist them with paying for the cost for more folks who are relying on the system. We also, to address some of the concerns that the other speaker raised, we also saw them recently enact the state children's health insurance program and reauthorize that for an additional 5 years. That will also help to expand coverage to many of the working poor who before had difficulty accessing it through the Medicaid program. So there's been some efforts at the federal level to try and address these issues. But certainly, we are, to the point that you just raised, we're not clear whether that's going to be sufficient enough because we don't know when exactly this is going to come to an end. But Medicaid and the CHIP program are certainly buffers to help ensure that we address some of these issues. But I think I feel like we keep skirting around what is the real issue here, which is the need for healthcare reform in this country. If we really want to be able to compete in a global economy with other first-tier countries, we're going to need to ensure that every American in this country has access to health care insurance. That will help us to have a stable, reliable workforce that will allow us to compete and will help to address some of the issues around the disproportionate number of minorities who suffer from heart conditions, from diabetes, and from cancer, which we know are two-thirds of the drivers around healthcare costs. So I just feel like it's like this 300-pound gorilla that we've been circumventing, but I think Massachusetts speaks to the reason why we need to act. Massachusetts was a great effort in moving that, but until we address issues around ERISA and federal barriers that prevent the move towards universal health care coverage, I think we're going to be just skirting around the issue.
Okay. So, well, we see it reflected in the president's budget. You know, people want to say he's spending too much money, but we have not just the economic problems that caused the immediate downturn, but these chronic issues like the underinsured problem we have in the United States. So you can't come out of this as a economy moving forward without addressing the healthcare issue. So a lot of people who see the amount that he's put in the budget for that are questioning why we would spend that amount of money. But if we don't make the plans to make the changes now, it only gets more complicated. And as this recession deepens, a big part of Medicaid expenditures also go to the elderly. In fact, it's very cheap to cover children under Medicaid. The big problem that states face are those folks who are dual eligible for Medicaid and Medicare, and they are very expensive to maintain. The Medicaid eligibility for the elderly is a means-tested on assets, and as people have lost their homes, as their retirement funds have disappeared, there are going to be more people who actually are eligible for Medicaid in the elderly portion of the program. So this is going to be a big strain on states, and so that's why we don't know. As you know, we're getting a little bit of good news that maybe housing prices have stabilized, but we don't know that we've come all the way through some of the problems on these mortgage instruments. We have another nightmare ahead of us on some adjustable rate mortgages that will adjust next year that is bigger than the subprime market problem. So we don't know that we're out of the woods on this at all, and that may affect the Medicaid expenditures we see going forward for the elderly, So if we don't get a handle on health coverage and figure out how we can have a more rational program, it may get us earlier than those plans are anticipating.
Okay. So unemployment rises mean lower tax base that the states can collect from. It means a rise in the number of people who are eligible for Medicaid, meaning more numbers. States are required to balance their budget. How does all of this happen given the economy that we have right now, and how do we expect states to be able to handle the budgetary issues and the increase in need for programs such as Medicaid?
Well, the Recovery Act included a large chunk of money to go to states to address these specific types of issues, but for 2 years. And the, as you mentioned, the lower revenues on the state side from lower consumption and lower property tax values puts this big strain on the states. It may turn out that we may have to go back and give additional aid to the states, because the way we have thought about state-based insurance programs like Medicaid or even the unemployment insurance system has been that these would be local effects, not the broad systemic failure that we're seeing right now. And so it is not really the way we design these programs. States really can't address a systemic failure of this nature, and Congress needs to prepare itself that after 2 years, the budget crisis in the states may not have gone away, and Congress may have to respond again. It may have to monitor how things go with Medicaid, because, again, we don't know what's going to happen with the elderly and this big drop in wealth that's taking place on the consumer household side. The household sector lost over $6 trillion in wealth in the last year. So there has to be this room in public space and in dialogue for Congress to be prepared to go back and help the states again.
And I would really echo that, particularly because 49 out of the 50 states have balanced budget requirements, either statutory or constitutionally. So unlike with the federal government, where we can run a national deficit, they don't have that financial ability. So there's going to be a real need for a greater partnership between the federal and state government in terms of being able to provide the resources so that states can remain afloat because of these requirements.
Mm-hmm. And as a voice from a state, I can tell you that we are facing substantial budget cuts across all sectors of state government for all of the reasons just outlined. Certainly in the Department of Public Health, we are looking at a substantially decreased budget for FY10 compared to where we started at FY09. And that's including the fact that during this past year, in both October and January, the governor made cuts in anticipation that our revenues were going to be decreased, and our FY10 budget is still substantially below where we were even with those two intra-year cuts. So it's very real for state government, and within the Department of Public Health, the magnitude of the cuts we're having to face means that we really have to you can't just trim. There's just not that much fat, so we're having to substantially reduce, you know, some programs that might, you know, very well be considered core programs. Luckily, today, Governor Patrick has announced that he's going to be using some of our federal recovery dollars within the healthcare sector, and some of that money is going to come back to the Department of Public Health to help sustain some programs that took pretty big cuts in the FY10 budget. Some of that money will go to the Medicaid program to allow us to continue to cover folks, and we'll get an increase on the federal matching side for that, which will be, you know, a great addition. But there's a lot of programs in the state, our Department of Mental Health, our Department of Mental Retardation, that have all been forced to make substantial reductions.
That is, and I thank you for bringing that up, because I actually did want to, as we transition to what the budget means in the economic downturn and your ability as a Department of Health, broadly speaking, but within your specific Department of Public Health, the departments of health in states do more than just provide and manage Medicaid and the SCHIP programs, and you do so much more than that. And the impact of the budgets that we're seeing cutbacks, how do you see that affecting your ability to do your job for your communities?
Well, I think that it's, in some cases, certain activities were left sort of untouched. We didn't have to change a significant portion of our, for example, substance abuse treatment services. We get a fair amount of federal money from there. And but on the other hand, some of our the proportion of state funds for our tobacco cessation programs was decreased significantly. And we had made really substantial gains in Massachusetts in terms of the rates of smoking and deaths from smoking-related illnesses like heart disease, stroke, and other cardiovascular disease. You know, we've had to make, you know, cuts in some of our school-based health centers, for an example. So all that is to say that you're right, it's not just about mass Medicaid, but we are doing our best to think creatively about how we can reorganize the delivery of some of these programs so that we don't leave sort of gaping holes where there were important programs before, but we really are heavily constrained by the magnitude of the budget cuts that we have been faced with.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions, Dr. Smith, that we just received was you mentioned the Department of Mental Retardation and some of the mental health that's going on there. And could you speak a little bit to some of the mental health disparities that we see in communities of color and how the economic downturn might influence those? We talked earlier about increases in anxiety disorders and things like that.
Well, there's been quite a lot of work around issues of mental health disparities, both in the diagnosis of different kinds of mental health conditions as well as in the approach to treatment. And unfortunately, for some of our communities of color, particularly among youth, their entry into receiving mental health services is through the juvenile justice system, whereas other folks might enter through a different door. Many of our youth of color end up entering through the juvenile justice system, which is obviously not ideal and sets up a whole dynamic that, you know, we wouldn't have if they had been diagnosed with their mental health or substance abuse issue first before entering a legal or juvenile justice system. So that's one issue. The other really is how people perceive symptoms and the kinds of screening that goes on and how much different populations of people describe their emotional or mental health to providers. And there's people have differing levels of comfort with doing that. And certainly there's, you know, substantial issues with disparities in diagnosis. Happily, again, with this new announcement that just came out just a few minutes ago, some money is going to be put back into the Department of Mental Health budget. So we're, you know, it's going to be better than we had predicted. But mental health and other kinds of health disparities obviously are persisting and something we were working very hard to address.
So one of the other groups that we've kind of not talked about in this conversation is the health providers and how are they weathering this storm, the hospitals, the community health centers. What do we know about what's going on there?
Well, we know, according to the American Hospital Association, they performed kind of a rapid response survey in November comparing 3 months in 2008 to the same 3 months in 2007 to try and identify the consequences of the economic crisis. And their hospitals were reporting that 38% of the hospital survey reported decreases in admissions, and the volume was down across the board in utilization categories. So we're talking about inpatient surgeries, ambulatory surgery visits, emergency visits, and discharges were all in the negative. So clearly, even folks, you know how we normally think with the uninsured, that they're going to the emergency rooms, even if you're uninsured, you're still exposed to healthcare costs. And in fact, it's much more if you're uninsured than if you were insured. We all know the example of the, you know, it's a $10 pill if you're insured versus a $100 aspirin if you're uninsured. And they're just not willing to expose their family to that type of economic disparity. And so many of them are just refraining from going in and getting the care that they need.
And Dr. Smith, what are we seeing in the community health centers in Massachusetts?
Well, we have seen a substantial increase in the visits, overall visits to community health centers. There's also a sense that there might be some increases among folks who still remain uninsured. As you would expect, there's always going to be a pocket of folks who, for various reasons, aren't able to enter the insurance system. So that creates a substantial issue that community health centers have to face. And I think they are having to deal with an increase in volume of patient visits at the same time that they're weathering their own storm, if you will, with their own fiscal and budgetary issues. And I just one other piece that I would put into this context is that, you know, we've been talking about state and federal government, but a fair amount of not solely health programming, but I would say more broad-based kind of programming has traditionally been funded through philanthropy, some more creative programs, for example, that might be based in a health center. Well, you know, that sector is also contracting substantially, and there's a lot of folks who have either lost funding or had it decreased or promised funding from private foundations got sort of withdrawn. So, you know, some of these health centers that were lucky enough to be the recipient of, say, a grant from a financial institution to do a certain kind of program, well, they might have that program just sort of pulled out from under them because that financial institution can't make that grant anymore.
Right. So we've kind of, I think, touched on all of the aspects that this is having and its effect on health and health outcomes in terms of the economic downturn. So what can we do? What are some of the things we could hope to see? And I know we've already, Dr. Spriggs, you've mentioned the stimulus package a couple of times and some of the provisions that are in there. Let's talk a little bit more about that. So you mentioned the COBRA coverage for people who lose their job. And we did have a question about whether or not we will see a lag in the health coverage effects because of COBRA. And you mentioned that about a third of people actually who are eligible take it up. Why do we see such low numbers?
Well, the Recovery Act actually helps people in a way we have not in the past. In the past, if you became unemployed, you really had to come up with the money yourself for the COBRA payment. If you were getting assistance under the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act, we did have a provision that was administered by the IRS to help front the money so that you could make the COBRA payment. But even there was a very low take-up rate. And really the problem is the cash flow issue. People have a dramatic drop in income even when they're getting these unemployment checks because it only covers about 30% of your normal pay. So they don't have the cash flow in order to meet the house payment, the food, and all the other things that they have to do, and then take care of health care costs. So in this Recovery Act, the government stepped in for the first time to help people who are getting unemployment checks, but only a third of people get an unemployment check. So that's going to be a severe problem. And a lot of people, even if they can access the health insurance, can't really do it for their family. That's an additional amount of money. So it becomes very difficult for families to try and keep up with their insurance coverage. We also have the problem that companies are facing the strain of health care costs going up on them and whether they can absorb in this current climate having higher health care costs and whether they will do as they have been doing the last 8 years, push more of that as out-of-pocket expense on the employees, telling them that they will have to pay more for the premium from their own pocket to maintain access to health insurance. So that's the big strain we see going on right now, and I think there will be a lag. There are some hospitals who are, surprisingly, even though I said that health was the one area where we were still hiring people, where they are going to have to do some layoffs because they have seen this downturn, and clients, and they can't, if they're not seeing patients, they're like any other business. They have to make adjustments too. And that lag may continue for some time because as this recession deepens and we have more sectors affected than before, the retail sector started its downturn around Christmas, and we see more retailers that are really strained because of the drop in consumption. And so as this deepens, we may see more people lose coverage, and that will have an impact on hospitals. People in the retail sector are the ones who are least likely to get unemployment insurance because of the way that the industry is structured, and their employees tend to be part-time, and part-time workers tend not to get unemployment insurance, even though the bigger retailers may have given those workers access to health insurance. So it's going to be a lag in terms of what we see, I think, both impact on the actual industry and the impact on health of the workers.
There is one other proactive thing that I can recommend. Consumers Union, we're the nonprofit publisher of Consumer Reports magazine, and we received a grant from the National Association of Attorney Generals to disseminate information through our Best Buy Drugs initiative. Based on a Kaiser Family Foundation wonderful survey, your respondents were reporting that 41% of them are having difficulty with addressing their prescription costs. And what this Best Buy Drug initiative does is it looks at the safety and efficacy of various drugs and to determine, you know, what are the various choices that are out there. So to give you an example of this, you've all heard of the purple pill, Nexium. Well, a Nexium basically will cost you approximately around like $190 a month for a prescription. But Prilosec OTC, which is the generic version of it, is around like $24 a month. And through our research, we have determined that basically just as safe and just as effective the generic drug. So we have looked at a variety of different conditions that disproportionately impact the minority community, such as asthma, such as depression, such as heart disease in terms of high blood pressure, and diabetes. And we translated that information, for example, in diabetes, into Spanish and obviously in English. And we have a new publication out called Best Drugs for Less. And if you want to hear more information about our Best Buy Drugs, I encourage you to go to bestbuydrugs.org. And we're really trying to reach out to the minority community and make this information much more readily available to them. And that is a part of our grant. So I really encourage you to let your friends and family and other folks know so that we can disseminate this. Because this is certainly a way that you can cost, you know, just look at that difference, how much more you could spend on food and housing if you didn't have to use the brand as opposed to the generic.
And we have the president's budget before us now. And that's going to be a very important fight because, again, we had a lot of deficiencies in our economy. They're now apparent to us, one of those being health care. And so while a lot of people want to rail about the spending money, we actually have to make investments. And we were underinvesting in the American people. And one of those key investments is in health. So while it may look like a lot of money, people should now be used to seeing big numbers. So every day they pick up the paper, there's $100 billion for this bailout or $100 billion for that bailout. The amount that he wants to put in for underlining and figuring out what we can do in healthcare, when they see billions of dollars, if we can bail out companies, we can certainly bail out the health of the American people for billions of dollars and undo this lack of investment we've put into solving that problem. So going forward, people can make a lot of noise about this budget fight and understand that the government has to make some investments. There's a big difference between saving and investing. Investing means you have to put some money out. Then that's not the same thing as saving. And this is a time when we have to correct some investment balances in the United States.
And if we do that, we know that prevention saves money. We know it across the board. I'm sure that the doctor on the line can talk about how WIC, by providing money, providing food and nutrition to pregnant women and children, that we know how many dollars that saves. So you're absolutely right. If we make these investments in the long term, we'll certainly be able to reap the savings, because the route that we're currently on is just not sustainable.
And so, Dr. Smith, in the President's stimulus package, he does have some information, or the recovery package, he does have information for food assistance for WIC and some of the school-based programs. When might you guys expect at the state level to see some of that money?
Oh, that is the multi-million dollar question for sure, and it's one that all of us in state government are asking. We are very pleased and relieved to be getting some of the funds that you mentioned. As another example, we'll be getting some additional funds for early intervention, which is a very important service in terms of what Ms. Hahn talked about, investment and, you know, saving money. We know that if we can help kids with their developmental delays before they have to go to school and require special education services, that, you know, that should be considered a wise and prudent investment. So we're hoping that we'll be able to see some of those funds by late spring. Our fiscal year starts in July, so we're hoping that we'll be able to see some of those in the current FY09 fiscal year, but then some of it undoubtedly we won't get until FY10 after July. Mm-hmm. But I think that in terms of one of the other things that people can do, to your back to your question, from a state's point of view, I think we've gone through this process trying to be as thoughtful as we can in terms of thinking about what are the core sort of safety net programs that we must provide in what, you know, is considered this counter-cyclical situation where, you know, some of our the requirement for our services go up as the funding for them goes down. And, you know, many of the things that we do fall into that category. So we're trying very hard to be strategic in how we manage our budget decreases. On the flip side, I think will be the families who may have not had to take advantage of certain kinds of safety net programs feeling okay about having to do that. And I think for some families that's harder. As I mentioned, we've seen this increase in subsidized school lunches, for an example. So, but there were, you know, concerns that people had about, you know, is this maintaining the confidentiality about that, since they weren't sort of used to having to do that before. So there's a whole host of things that we can do, I think, as a department to make sure that, you know, people feel comfortable accessing the services that are available to, again, not totally take care of everything, but perhaps buffer some of the hard edges.
Mm-hmm. And so, Dr. Smith, you mentioned a couple of times now the increase in the number of people on school lunch programs. And Dr. Spriggs, I know you previously wrote about sort of the school lunch programs and what happens in the summer when school ends. And so what happens in the summer when school ends for these kids?
Well, this is a big problem. A number of cities have fashioned ways of keeping the schools open precisely so they could continue to access the funds, both for school lunch and for school breakfast. It's a big problem that we face in a lot of our urban areas and in many of our rural communities. How do we keep ensuring that children will get nutritious food? The big problem is that while families may have access to food stamps, the, you know, fortunate thing of this Recovery Act is that there was an increase in food stamps so that people could begin to afford nutrition as opposed to affording calories. So this is a challenge that we're going to have to see urban areas continue to address to make sure that children can have access to nutritious food during the summer, and parents can feel confident. With so much stress being put on those who are still in the labor force, you know, the big problem for parents is monitoring what their children are going to eat during the summer. And so thinking that through now is very important.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Smith, what do you guys have, or have you thought about plans for the summer for the kids given the rise that you're seeing?
Well, there's there are multiple sort of summer programs that are available here in Massachusetts that, as part of the summer program, provide provide lunch, so at least we know the kids have that meal taken care of. I should say that our WIC enrollment has also increased substantially over the past several months, more than we had even projected. So I think to some extent people are reaching out for the food assistance. And I would say that one other piece of what we're doing, even though that we're in this sort of challenging fiscal situation, is that we are maintaining a focus on a wellness initiative that really has within it a heavy emphasis on looking at health disparities in communities of color and thinking about ways of making communities healthier overall, including the kinds of issues that Dr. Spriggs said in terms of what's the nutritional landscape in a community. Is there no grocery store but, 10 fast food restaurants? Well, that gets into the situation where he talked about you get calories but you don't get nutrition. And so we are trying very hard to maintain a focus on that initiative even as we are, dealing with these budget deficits. So we're going to be funding some community-level public-private partnership grants so that communities can gather some of the unusual suspects, if you will, to talk about health in their community. So not just the health folks, but the planning folks, the transportation folks, the parks and recreation people, the economic development folks. So we're seeing that as a very real way that we can get after some of these things.
Good. It sounds like we still have a lot more to learn as we're going to see what happens with the current economic situation as it continues and changes, and monitoring what's happening health-wise and how the system is adapting to the increased need. But I would like to thank Adrian and Dr. Spriggs and Dr. Smith for joining me today. And I would like to thank all of you for your questions. On our webpage, you'll find resources on today's topics that may be useful to you. Again, I'm Kara James of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.